how would you define retention, and then let's pick up from there and see where it goes.
Sure. So interesting question, right? How I define retention, because it's unlike, say, acquisition. It's very, very dependent on the kind of business that you're running and the nature of the product and things like that, right? Like the way you think about retention for, say, e-commerce is going to be radically different for a SaaS product company. It will be very different for enterprise versus SMB, stuff like that. But I think for me, the major piece, the way I look at it is, and this kind of helps tie the entire life cycle back to marketing and acquisition in terms of looking at it in terms of your CAC payback period, right? So
Right.
if you've kind of got a certain cost of acquisition of customer, which is CAC, you're typically looking at how soon do I kind of get that money paid back by my customer, right? And retention is, for me, is typically looking at retaining the customer at least to that point, and ideally beyond, right? Because if you are not retaining a customer at least, say, to your payback period, then you have a bit of a problem on your hands that the money that you're spending to bring in that customer, you are not kind of recovering that back from them through their product usage or their transactions on your site or the purchases that they made, right? So if you're setting a target, and some of this will be historical based on how you've been running the business, but for a brand new business, it's very often a target that you're to set, saying that I can afford to take 6 months to recover my money on this customer, or I can take just 3 months, or if it's a more transaction based, it could be like I need three transactions for them
Right.
to recover my the cost that I spent on them. Or it could be even something like for very high value purchases, like if you're buying, say, a suit, for example, it could be like I can recover this in one purchase, right? It could be as simple as that. For something like, say, cosmetics and stuff like that, which is low ticket items, you may say I need 25 transactions
Right.
to capture that back. So then we'll look at retention in terms of that at least till that point, I need to retain my customers till that point. Otherwise, I've kind of lost money on this customer. And then you have to scale that up to say, okay, on this customer versus this cohort versus this group that I've acquired this month. And there are 150 ways to cut this. You can cut this by channel, you can cut this by monthly groups, you could cut this by products that you're selling, stuff like that. To take like the cosmetics one, you could take like everyone who's bought kajal sticks, or everyone who has bought lipstick or eyeliner, you could cut it on those lines. You could cut it on everyone who has come in through Diwali sale. You could cut it through everyone who's come in through an event, right? And see, okay, what is my payback period? How much have I spent to acquire these customers? I need to get my money back. There are different benchmarks, of course, on terms of like your lifetime value to acquisition of your customer acquisition cost benchmarks, right? Like typically, especially for product companies, we talk about a magic number of, say, 3:1. That the lifetime value of your customer has to be, let's say, 3x what you paid to get them in the door, right? And if you're thinking about, say, a 3 year lifetime for that customer, you're looking at a payback period of 1 year. That is, you're making money for the customer over 3 years. They're giving you 3x the money that you spent to bring them in the door, which means you will break even in 1 year, which means you should retain them at least till that 1 year. If they're going to bounce out in 6 months, you've lost money on that customer. Whereas if they stay for 2 years, your second year revenue is profit, right? At a gro at least at a unit economics, not factoring in, say, cost of your product and net margin and all that. But at least like cost to acquire plus the money you got, at least 1 year of profit you made, right? Similarly, for transaction paid based businesses, it's if you're looking at, say, I acquired a customer at 100 rupees, I hope to make $1,000 off them. Then you're and the average person makes, say, five transactions, then you're looking to make, say, 200 per transaction. Then
Right.
they should at least make one transaction. Or if it's, say, 20 transactions and it's 50 rupees per transaction, you should hope for at least two transactions, right, to cover that 100 rupees that you spent. Then after that, the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh transaction is all basically at an
You're in the
acquisition
positive,
level,
yeah.
yeah, you're in the positive, right? And that is once you factored in other costs for the business, money that you can plow back into growth.
Correct. So this is a very obviously one thing that, you know, all of us can make out is you seem to be thinking in terms of hardcore numbers. The whole logic is built around, I have invested X number of dollars or rupees to get this customer in. How fast do I recover that? And then how can I make more on top of that? Right. And there is also this, as you mentioned, there is a historical basis for making an assumption or a hypothesis that you've got this much time duration in which to do all of that recovery.
Correct.
So now coming to that, it looks like there are two things going on, right? One is you need to hang on to them for a certain duration of time. And based upon what kind of industry it is, once they get in through the door, the clock starts ticking, and then you have got this much amount of time in which to recover the money. And now the problem is, if you think in terms of math, it's like, do I need to get them to do only one transaction, or do I need to get them to do multiple transactions? Now, can we move into how should somebody think about this in terms of how soon it needs to be the first transaction, right? Because sometimes I imagine that there could be some businesses where you could acquire somebody and sort of bring them into your ecosystem, but they may not be immediately ready to make that first transaction, right?
Yeah.
So and the reason I'm asking this is because you know, some of our audience right now, and even those who are going to listen later, they may be coming from a wide range of situations.
Correct.
So some of them, like e-commerce, could be, I just create a login, I go look at some dress that I like, and I just buy it right away. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas something else is like, okay, I just entered the ecosystem, and now I need to think about many things because it's what we would call a considered purchase. You're going to spend significant amount of money, etc., right? So help us sort of dissect this. How do people put some sort of general thought around what if I need to hang on to a customer for a while before the transaction happens? Right. So there is some sort of engagement angle coming into the whole retention problem, right?
Correct. There is, right. One example that I like to use very often because it's something that pretty much anyone could relate to is like Apple, right? You buy an iPhone. You are not going to say buy an iPhone every year, or, you know, certainly not for the next 1 year. Most people are not going to, right? Right. It's not a frequent purchase. It is a very expensive purchase. It's a very considered purchase. You know, it's not an impulse purchase at all. So, you know, they have that kind of a problem where it's not someone that you can come in, and everything is expensive in Apple, right? So that speaks exactly to your point. The thing here is, if you look at the way Apple constructs the customer's journey, right? It's highly broken down into a lot of discrete steps, a lot of granular steps. And what they are trying to do is kind of inject some kind of delight at many places into this. And it's kind of important to realize here that when you break down a customer journey, and like if I take Apple, right, it's like going to the website, looking at the product, looking at the specs, comparing it, going to the store, touching, feeling the product, finally buying it, it lands up at your house, and then there's the entire unboxing experience, and then, you know, opening it up, right? There are many steps in this. Not all steps are born equal. Some steps have a disproportionate impact on the way the customer perceives the transaction or perceives the interaction and relationship with the business. Another example is like, which anyone can relate to, is like taking a flight. Right, there's a lot of steps in this. Not all steps are born equal. You know, passing through security is one step, checking into the flight is another step, taking the flight itself is a third step. Right, different steps have different impact on how at the end of the flight I kind of, how do I feel about this, and how satisfied or how delighted I am about this, right? And you know what Apple does beautifully is identifying the critical ones and kind of creating an aha moment around this, right? So the classic one which everyone talks about is like the unboxing process for an iPhone, right? Because one thing that can really hit a purchase which is high value or a high ticket size is like buyer's regret, that I've spent so much on this phone, or I spent so much on this product, or I spent so much on this shirt, and like, my God, it's not really like, you know, living up to my expectations. And Apple has identified that step as being disproportionately important to the customer's, you know, entire interaction with them, and just blown it out of the park. Like, no one does an unboxing like Apple does, right? From the packaging down to the way you switch on the device to everything. So, and I think that's something that can be, you know, replicated a lot into digital products as well. Like, look at how we do our, you know, signups and the first steps into the product. And can we, even if we don't make money right now, how can we kind of do, create a lot of aha moments and a kind of sense of delight in the customer's journey, such that at least at an emotional level, there is a very positive sentiment. And that will over time slowly build up to a point like saying, okay, let me give you my money. Right. Another example I can give from a more digital world is like, say, Canva, right? Another, say, product that I like using Canva because it has a huge spectrum of users, from enterprise down to like college students even use Canva, right? So most of them are free. Most of them don't, Canva doesn't earn a single rupee or cent off them. But the way they've delivered the product journey across how you make the product, there's a lot of delight, there's a lot of discovery, there's a lot of, wow, cool, I didn't know I could do that, or, oh, wow, this looks amazing, right? There's a lot of that happening. Yeah. And then when you finally make something, there's a huge sense of like joy and satisfaction that comes out of that, you know, I created.
Accomplishment, this. Yeah.
Exactly, right? And that builds up. And then you're like, finally, after 3 months, you're like, you know, let me pay for that pro account and get access to those additional features. Right. So it's kind of important to do that and not look at it in terms of a transaction, but more of a relationship.
It's like almost like a, okay, the transaction is out there in the future, but how can you generate that hope in the customer that while I know that you have not made up your mind to go with me yet, but I'm going to sort of prove how good I am right from the go, that chances are that, you know, there's a high probability that you'll end up going with me after that X number of days or months or weeks, right?
Correct.
So I remember, you know, in I think probably you and I share a love of this common metric, time to first value.
Correct.
So talk a little bit about that, because I feel somehow that that's a critical thing for most of our audience to, I feel that they can just pay attention to that one thing and just do that, execute on that really strongly. There is like all is not lost. I mean, even if the customer is kind of in two minds, there's still chance that, you know, you've won their hearts in some way, right? So talk to us about that metric, Aditya, and like, what is its significance?
Absolutely, right. I won't name specific names in this, but there is a very big you know, SaaS company in India which they sell you know, called contact center software. And contact center software, as you can imagine, you're deploying it over, say, 5 to several thousand people at a call center, is not something that you pay a lot of money for it as a business. And it takes a while to set this up, get it rolled out, configure it to your needs, get everyone, you know, your 100 or thousands or whatever people using it, and then start seeing some benefit accrue out of this in terms of, and that benefit is not going to be like, you know, something very numerical. It'll be in terms of productivity, it'll be in terms of time, right? It'll be in terms of an indirect way. But they work very hard with their customers to find those small wins, right? Like saying, okay, we piloted with 20 people and those 20 people have already seen a 20% productivity improvement, right? And kind of communicating those back and saying that, listen, we are creating value for you. So the corollary here is, especially for, you know, software businesses where you're selling to at a high ticket value, a high contract value, you're selling to enterprise, there is an implementation curve for this. It's super important to kind of look at, you know, don't wait 6 months for the thing to get implemented and then you start showing value. How can I start finding ways to show value? And more important, not just finding value, but also communicating it back, right? You can't kind of rely on the customer to see that value for themselves. If you are generating value, it's your job to show that value as well, right?
That's a great thought, yeah.
Right? Where is well done probably in, say, e-commerce businesses is, why is Amazon Prime so popular? Is the way they communicate how fast shipping is with Amazon Prime and that it's free, right? It is, if you don't have Amazon Prime and you open any product on Amazon and you see that, you know, will come in 1 week at 100 rupees and then free tomorrow with Prime, right? That's a very tantalizing proposition and it's very hard to say no to, right? Yes. And they have, you know, probably their biggest investment in terms of the business is probably the supply distribution chain and getting that product to you tomorrow versus a week from now, right? And they've done that just to crash their time to value. That I bought it today, I see no value out of that purchase till it lands up in my hand. So why should I wait a week for that? Can I get it to you in a day? And yeah, it's an ambitious goal. They try to reach it. They've probably done it also in India. And yeah, that shows in terms of why that's been so popular.
And I also, you know, I remember this long article written by the growth head at Facebook. I think many people are familiar with his name, Chamath. So he's a really interesting guy, and he wrote this long article on Facebook about how they retained people and grew the whole business, right? And one of the things that he said is, it's not good enough nowadays for people to think in terms of time to first value in days. So he says, how can you cut it down to hours and then to minutes? And he says, can you even imagine it in seconds? So I find that to be really an inspiring way of thinking.
Yeah.
And so I want to shift gears slightly from, because you come from the world of marketing, Aditya, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel that there is any, there is a specific approach that marketers tend to take, for example, the whole CAC to LTV mindset? Do you feel, is it more of a marketing legacy, or is it like, if product people approach retention, how would they do? What I'm driving at is, retention ultimately becomes the problem of the whole company.
Correct.
And so how do all the different teams collaborate and, you know, who's going to do what in the whole game to make that happen? Can you talk about that in your experience?
Sure. So the framework I look at things, right, like whether it's acquisition, retention, or even say win back, let's say customers have churned out and you're trying to win them back, is, you know, what's a product that you're pitching? What's the value that you're trying to communicate? How are you communicating it, right? Like, you know, taking the Apple example again, the way they communicate their value is also very unique among other all mobile phone makers or, you know, laptop makers. The second piece is kind of like, where do I place those interventions, or where do I insert myself into the customer's, you know, larger life and the world that they live in? And yes, in retention, product tends to be the predominant channel for this, right? Because a lot of like marketing channels are not, you've already acquired them, so you're not going to try and reacquire them unless it's win back. But you know, a lot of it happens to happen through the product or communicating what your product has, whether it's through email or stuff like that, right? So for me, it's that, right? It's even if it's product, it sits inside this larger thinking around, who is my segment? What do I need to communicate? If say, you know, to take the Canva example again, if like, you know, I identify a group of users who are not using the product at the frequency or the depth that I am hoping to, or they're below par. We've identified the segment. What do I want to communicate with them? The second is, how do I reach them, right? And that is through the product, right? So,
right. So
it can almost be agnostic in that sense, right? If it's a product leader or a marketing leader or a customer success leader even who is looking or owning retention, it should not, the framework for thinking of this is kind of agnostic around how you talk to the customer or where your communication lands in front of their eyeballs.
So it's almost like what I'm hearing you say is, irrespective of who does it, and this can vary from company to company based on how they are used to thinking about this, but it seems like the core of whole retention is, no matter who does the communication should be structured around making value visible, right? Especially value that has already been delivered to the user. And if somehow they've kind of missed it, right?
Yeah.
Or they have downplayed it. For example, one of the things that I like is Cred, right? If you use Cred to do your credit card bills, they do this really cute thing every time you pay your bill, it says that was fast. And I've spoken about this in, I think, in some other context, other webinars also. They say it took like 11 seconds or 8 seconds, right? Correct. So it's just like just injecting that number. Although you have no way of finding out if other apps are equally fast or slow, it's just a way of, I say, like conversation starter, right? It's just something that's putting something, a little thing in your mind, like, hey, do you know this was so cool? Or
it's taking the value that they created, make it tangible, and put it front and center.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And not not relying on the user to understand, to figure it out for themselves. Like,
to explicitly recognize. Probably, you know, there are a few users who are like really knowledgeable about the whole thing. So they will be able to, they don't need to be told. They'll actually realize on their own. But there are actually many people who would be grateful just for the fact that you told them something cool about it. I remember one of these companies, I'm not sure if it's something like Fab India, right? So if you buy their stuff, they insert some sort of cards and it's totally by surprise. They don't tell you when. And when you take this card out, it will tell you something about the piece that you purchased, that the cotton came from so-and-so farmer, the farmer's family is like this. And they just try to humanize the whole thing. They just tell you little you know, beautiful pieces about the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
So it seems like value seems to be like a critical thing, and there is no way around it, right? You cannot have retention without value. Repeated demonstration of value.
Like, it is... Like, why, how could you possibly retain a customer who doesn't see value in your product? Right? We can try all kinds of tricks, like make it difficult to cancel, or, you know, hiding away the customer support number. We can try these moves, right? But finally, if they don't see value, what are you going to do? Like, if you don't let me cancel, I'll put, I'll just let my credit card expire. Right? It's as simple as that. Like, you can't retain them.
Go to social media and just give you a piece of my mind, right?
Yeah, you could, you know, it could be passive churn, or it could be aggressive churn like that too, absolutely.
Right. And okay, so can you tell us any story of how you approach the retention problem? You don't need to tell us anything that you don't have to, but if you can sort of tell us a story, in the paint a picture of how you went about a particular challenging retention problem, and after that, probably, you know, we'll have time for some Q&A. This is going to be not a very long conversation, so.
Sure, absolutely. I can talk about this probably about 4 or 5 years back. Won't go into the specifics because I don't want to name names here. But we were a tech product. We were targeted at developers. We were ideally built for small teams, small dev shops, individual freelancers, stuff like that. We were not in the enterprise market at all. And our thesis around why we had product market fit was, like, other players in this space were becoming more and more enterprisey in their product, right? Which made it more and more difficult and more complicated and more hard to manage their products if you're a small team. Right, in terms of billing, their features and stuff like that was becoming set up for big, large engineering teams, right? So we're like, okay, there are people who are dissatisfied there. They will come if we can kind of, you know, roll back the clock and give them a simple product, right? We launched this very fast in the market. We were a very scrappy startup at the time. It was literally 10 devs, myself and a fresher, right? Myself and the fresher and two product managers. So four of us were non-engineering people, and we were scrapping up. We had reached around, say, a few thousand MRR at a time. A lot of acquisition, a lot of focus obviously was on acquisition, because we needed to get users in the door. We needed to get more and more users in the door, trying the product to really stress test our PMF and to also kind of figure out our next product roadmap, right? We needed people to use the product and tell us what they wanted next. So obviously, like, of the 385 priorities I had, churn was not in the top of five, at least for the first few months, right? But I also knew it was not something I could ignore, because acquisition is expensive in this space. As you can imagine, we're going up against big players who are targeting enterprise. They have like 9 zeros after me, beyond me in the budget. So then when we looked at churn, or we looked at it, you know, a lot across a lot of segments, by channel, by, you know, even like time of day of when they signed up, and from the geography and things like that. But finally, we kind of went on monthly cohorts. And we what we realized is this, that our churn was pretty significant. Not because our core product was bad or we didn't have PMF, but because we were very raw as a product. And like, you know, a lot of things around the user journey was rough and kind of scrapped together, right? Like, if someone forgot their password, they had to email us.
Got it. Right. Fiction.
Yeah, right. So the that kind of things were there. So people like, nice product, great idea, but we'll probably come back when you're kind of more complete, right? But at the same time, what we did see was this small growing base of users who were kind of irrationally loyal to us.
That's, I like
while
that.
While everyone else was leaving, like, you know, this is too much pain for me. Like, these guys are like, you know, I was like, okay, why are you staying with me? And obviously, the, you know, one crucial step in all this, obviously, to actually talk to users. And that's what we did. And we understood what this was. And that really kind of helped us drive very tightly on who our ideal customer profile is, right? And obviously, as an early stage, we were, you know, shooting at a bunch of different profiles and personas, trying to see where we would kind of get, you know, strong attraction. And that kind of came out in this. And, you know, the hard lesson from this was we needed to go really narrow. We needed to focus absolutely on this ICP and completely build for them. We had to build a product, our customer journey, finding those moments of delight, where the aha moments are landing. Everything is around these ICPs, right? And these were basically like senior developers over, say, 8, 10, 12 years of work experience who were, you know, and this was, say, probably before the big startup boom in India. So a lot of these guys were starting. These are probably the first generation of startup thinkers in the country. And
what's ICP? Sorry.
Ideal customer profile, right? So,
ideal customer. Yeah, got it.
Sorry, I tend to fall into acronyms a lot. Yeah, so these were senior devs who were starting to build things on the side, who were starting to experiment with new products, solve problems for themselves that they were facing at work, right? And they wanted some lean, clean architecture product that they could use, which is not as complicated and messy as what they're using
right
in their enterprises. So mm-hmm. we're like, okay, let's build for them. Let's build our product ecosystem around that, right? So yes, it was a little hairy a few months before we kind of turned the churn story around, where, you know, our ideal customers who are staying loyal to us started to outweigh guys who are coming in and walking out the door at the same time, right? A lot of juggling to be done for those few months because we're also trying to, you know, accelerate acquisition at the same time. But yeah, I think we made it through pretty well.
Perfect. There is one amazing insight that comes out of this story, Aditya, which is sometimes, you know, if there is churn, mm-hmm. I think rather than just having this knee-jerk panic reaction to it, I think it profits to ask, you know, who is churning out? Is it your ideal customer profile or ICP, as you said, or is it somebody else? So can you talk about, you know, maybe take a couple of minutes and just help us think around this point? How do you know which churn to react to and which churn to say, I sort of suspected that would happen, and let me actually focus on the people who are staying back and make it smoother. And so slowly my acquisition is also going to shift towards more of the people who are loyal. So it's almost like iterative logic in acquisition, right? The first wave of people that you get in is like a mix of those who are meant for you and those who are not. And then some of them are churning out, and you have to now figure out a logic to think of, okay, whom to pay attention to when they are churning out and whom not to, right? So how do you do that balancing?
So in very interesting question here, right? And I'll kind of hang my hat on what I was talking about around irrational loyalty, that you will find customers who are, you know, like, you look at the data and you're like, why are they still buying from me? Practically at that level, right? And you go back and you look across their history with you, or you look at their profile, where they came from, demographics, somewhere you'll find a pattern, right? You know, in the previous example that I gave, what we saw here was one pattern that we noticed was a very fast acceleration in their product adoption. So whatever product usage metrics we had, it was like sign up at 11 o'clock, and then like 1 o'clock, it's like gone straight up, right? Whereas everyone else was kind of slowly going up, right? You'll find those patterns. And that's the way to kind of look back and then use that as a way to identify the same segment of users as they're coming in the door.
Right. Like hunger almost, right?
Absolutely, right? Again, to take Canva, like maybe their most loyal customers or their ideal profile is people who say, I'm just making this up. I have no idea, but I'm just making this up. Who makes, say, 3 designs in the first week of signing up, right? And then maybe you focus and center all your efforts on retention against everyone who has signed up and has done completed 3 designs in the first week. And you're like, okay, these are the guys I have to focus on. If I have to retain somebody in my entire user base, it should be these guys. If I lose the others, I live with that, but these I cannot afford to lose. Right. So you have to find those signals, you have to find those metrics that are predictive of saying that these guys are going to be, irrationally loyal and, supremely profitable for you going forward as well. Right. So how do you predict that? It's obviously going to dramatically vary from business to business. I remember many years ago hearing about this from one of the earliest kind of health e-commerce businesses in the country. And, that was a time when you didn't have as many as you had right now. But they were like, people who buy protein shake are my ideal customer profile. If they have the guts, this is, I'm talking about a decade ago, to buy something like this online, mm-hmm. right? They will buy pretty much anything from me. Right. I don't care if the person who tried to buy say N95 masks came back or didn't come back, but these guys are a big deal to me and they matter, and I will do anything to hold on to them. And once I hold on to them, I will try and cross sell them anything because I don't know what else they pick up.
So it's almost like what you're saying sounds like there are a few people who are sort of natural super users because of. And it's something about them, right? And something about them, and they are like, I don't bother about all the little, friction here and there. But I see the value this product brings to me, and I'm going to spend my time, figure out ways to use it, in ways that I want to, and keep moving forward, right? And it's almost like then you say, okay, so you have sort of elected yourself into my product. Right,
pretty much, yes.
I've just put it out there, but you're playing with it.
Yeah,
and therefore I'm going to just focus on you, and everyone else who's a little slow on the uptake, well, I might still do something for them, but like you are the person who's so drawn to my product that now I am forced to sort of be drawn to you and look after you, and then slowly kind of find more people like that, right?
Yeah, and the rest of the segment is not someone to kind of ignore, but right. Like I was saying, that to take the come back to the Canva example, if like say, doing 3 designs in 1 week is a signal, then there is obviously some kind of significant delight or some superior level of value that people are seeing, which correlates to that action, right? It could be on an e-commerce like like buying the protein shake, for example. So how do you kind of nudge people who are not in that segment to get into that segment? Because maybe they'll see the same value that people who naturally landed up there are seeing if you can kind of nudge them into it, right? So that's, right. A kind of way to look at retention in a more proactive way. So like, that was the goal of the guys running the, health e-commerce business. Like people come in to buy 50 rupee items, 100 rupee items, but can I nudge them to buy a protein shake? Because for whatever reason, that is a fantastic signal of their retention. So let me get them there. I'm too new and too early to understand what exactly they're seeing in terms of the value that makes them love my platform. But let me match them there and see what happens.
Right. And then maybe if you can find ways to convert even a few of those people, right, into your protein shake segment, then you're almost sort of doing an acquisition all over again, right? And that's pretty cool.
Yes and no, because it is far more efficient, right? Because you already have a relationship going with them. So in terms of your costs and everything, it's far more efficient. So it's definitely like between acquiring a new user to buy protein shake, whereas, cross-selling protein shake to an existing user, like no contest.
It's just that I was trying to think of it as another form of a more product specific acquisition, not a relationship acquisition.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, I mean, cross sell is a probably easier term to go with. Perfect. So we have some questions, and let's see which one. Let's pick the biggest one, right?
Okay.
It's from Somalia, and he says, I feel that with markets getting saturated and products becoming equally fast, capable, and competent, I think he's talking about differences vanishing really quickly between products. The value prop, no matter how well presented or quickly presented, he's not sure that that will be enough to make it stand out. And he's saying new age marketers may have to create new types of value and construct something that appeals to users at a gut level, right? And then, so a course on psychology could be useful here. What do you think? That's an interesting question.
Interesting question, yes. I think, I mean, I've never taken a course on psychology. I don't think I've even taken a course. I've done an MBA, but I don't think I ever did anything on consumer behavior. But I think, Somalia, the larger question here is just being a good observer of human behavior, identifying pain points, right? Coming back to Casey's example about cred, there's a great observation that they have made here that traditionally when you paid your credit card bill, what the bank would do, you had two banks, the bank you're paying, the account you're paying from, and the credit and the owner of the credit card, right? So you could be paying from like an HDFC bank account to an ICICI credit card. And both the banks would take their own sweet time, whichever banks it were, to recognize a payment and credit it to your credit card bill. So if you paid on, God forbid, you paid on the last date that it was due, they will credit it only 3 days later and mark it as late. And this is an observation they've made. There's no kind of formal learning here. They just noticed that, you know, this is a pain point and this is something that people have gotten trapped by again and again and again.
They've actually cared to see that.
I remember I used to do that automated credit card payment out of my bank account, and they used to do it on the credit card due date. It was a different bank from the credit card and used to get credited a week later. And every single time it used to be marked as late. Right? They've identified this. This is an observation. And then they have pushed this as saying, this is the value we have to create. So it's more about kind of, you know, making observation, right? Figma is another fantastic example. It is probably like peanuts compared to Photoshop in terms of the power of the product, in terms of the features and the graphic design capabilities. But they've identified one pain in creative teams that if three designers are working together, there's a huge, you know, upload, download, transfer problem, sending PSD files back and forth to each other. They've just observed that and they said, let's solve that pain point. And, you know, as much as tools are coming, the more tools getting saturated, it's also creating a lot more noise. Right, you ask a typical salesperson now how many different tools he uses, not just the CRM, but beyond that, versus the same thing 10 years ago, and it's just more messy. And there are always more pain points to identify. There's always more things for us to solve, right? And it's just a matter of observation, talking to people, talking to your customers, talking to your potential users, and just figuring out what those are.
I think it's a great, great answer, Aditya, because what effectively you're saying is, on the outside, it looks like all the products sort of sound similar, and maybe all of their websites give you the same sort of feeling that we're all competent, etc. But there is always something going on in the real world, right? And if you care to observe that and do something around it, then people do find a value. Perfect. Okay, there is another question around the metrics. How do you know actually if a retention strategy is actually working? Are there any metrics that we can track?
Yeah, so I think the most effective metrics to track are churn in itself. I am more biased towards revenue churn, because very often, especially in our businesses, we are multi-product and we have users who, you know, buy at different price points or different contract values. So, you know, more than user churn, I like to look at revenue churn in terms of, you know, because that gives you a real picture of how much money you're losing. And the way I look at it is like, you know, the typical metric for it is more of a retention metric, saying that, you know, I had 100 users at the beginning of the month, I've added 40 users, new users, I've lost 20. So, you know, my net churn is about, I think it will come out to be about 20%. There's a simple formula for it. But I try to look at it in terms of loss, because, and I try to look at it in terms of new revenue loss, right? So like the way I look at it is like, if you are say doing 20% new revenue month on month, but you are churning 5% of your revenue also month on month, you're basically, another way to frame it is you're losing 25% of all the new revenue that you've got is also right. walking out the door.
Yeah, right? 5% is 25% of 20%.
Exactly. One right? fourth, so, yeah. Correct. So you're making $1 million this month. You made that $1.2 million, but you've lost 5% of that. You lost $50,000. So you basically lost a quarter of what you made. And, right. And that's directly speaks to your acquisition costs. It's a very painful, visceral way of looking at it. That's almost completely unignorable. Right. And then kind of going one step down into that, I think CSAT is very important here. That said, I don't think a lot of businesses use CSAT very well. They just plunk it at the end of a transaction and then kind of demand a score from the user or the customer. But going back to what we were talking earlier in the call about breaking down the journey into a lot of discrete steps, identifying where there's disproportionate impact on the customer satisfaction, and then kind of asking where should I ask for if the customer is satisfied or not. Like, I've always asked myself this, Uber and Ola like to ask me at the end of a ride to give like 5 stars to this driver, but where is the right point to ask? Should they be asking at the time I get into the car? Because there is a huge stress and transactional friction on getting the cab itself, so maybe that's the right place to ask. I don't work for them, or should they be asking at the end of the ride? Or, these are questions that any, retention leader should be asking. Where's the right place to measure satisfaction with the intent of trying to predict future churn?
Right. Right. In other words, you're sort of imposing a purpose on measuring that CSAT is like,
yes,
fix something in the product, but also use it to predict churn.
Correct. If the user at this point is super crucial in how they think about me and their relationship with me, it's super important. So if they're unhappy here, this would predict that these guys are going to bounce out. They may finish this transaction, sure, they'll give me the money now, but they may bounce out because they have left a bad taste in their mouth at some point.
It sounds like if you've collected this data for over a period of time, sort of inverse correlation between, or let's say direct correlation between low CSAT at a particular point in the journey and churn will sort of expose that, that is the sensitive part of the journey, that is that disproportionate thing that you cannot afford to get wrong, because it's like 85% of people who said this step is like 3 out of 5 are no more with us.
Correct. Absolutely. And you don't even have to wait for that data, right? A lot of early stage businesses probably can't wait that long to get that kind of volume of data. And, collecting that data is difficult, but you can just go about this qualitatively as well, right? One insight we have in telco was, anyone enters a mobile phone store, most people enter a mobile phone store with a problem. Right. The SIM card is lost, they're overbilled, underbilled, something like that. Right. And you walk in and you don't know where to go. That first 30 seconds is disproportionately important on how they engage with the staff at the store. Right. If you're treated rudely or no one engages you, you're already stressed because your problem to solve. No one cares what you want. No one tells you where to go, or someone's like, kind of rough with you. Then, your entire demeanor, your sentiment on this transaction changes. But if someone's a little kind, if someone's a little helpful, it changes the game altogether, right? This is also true in, like your multi-brand retail stores. Like, you enter and they have 150 products, and you walk in and, some stores in the West have now started giving out differently colored shopping bags. saying like, you know, one colored shopping bag means I need help. I need someone to come and proactively assist me. Whereas other people are like, you know, the other color means leave me alone. I want to shop on my own. The point being that, you know, they're trying to help give the right experience at to the right person based on what they want. And because right. they've identified that that component is crazy important to the overall relationship. It's not just the quality of the product. It's not the price. It's not the checkout. But my shopping experience is so important that, you know, if you bug me there, I'm never coming back to your store. I may still buy it online at a cheaper price, but I'm not coming back to your store.
Absolutely. I think what a wonderful example, right? They've sort of asked people to classify themselves. And then the whole experience changes after that.
Correct.
Yeah. Perfect.
And digital products, it's like so much easier, right?
True. It's true. And I think there is also a variant on this answer when it comes to products that involve financial transactions versus products that don't involve any transaction. Because, you know, in our work in Upshot, we've also seen some clients who build apps that do not necessarily involve making any transactions. These are more or less like tools for a job. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a tool, not the tool for the job. In other words, you can drop this tool for another tool. It's like an example is like, you know, you want to drive a nail into the wall.
Yeah.
You can buy any hammer in the world for that, right? So it's a tool for a job. And that changes retention also differently, because there the functionality becomes supremely important. Ease of use, directness, speed, you know, giving you ideas, all these things matter supremely more, right?
Correct. And that's what, right? Like coming back to proactively communicating the value and what you stand for and what's important, right? Since you brought up a hammer, very, very similar product space is like a Swiss Army knife, right? And, you know, there are hundreds and thousands of brands of unbranded Swiss Army knives. Victorinox is like the branded red one. And then you have like Leatherman, right? It's a good case study if you look at their communication and how they help. They try to stand out for what is basically a handle with a screwdriver at one end and a knife at the other. Fundamentally, that's all it is they're not providing nothing unique, but they communicate it in such a way that, you know, Leatherman users feel like, no, I don't have a Swiss Army knife, I have a Leatherman, right? Don't, right? There's a difference there, right? They're able to communicate that. They find
there's almost like this feeling of be careful what you say.
Absolutely, right?
Right. Yeah, I think there was another question around LTV to CAC, but you've already answered that 3:1 is a good thumb rule to go, LTV to CAC ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And
it really depends, just expanding on that, right? It really depends on how much you have to invest in the relationship to get your money. Using, you know, SaaS as a easy way to explain this, like, you know, if you're selling to enterprise, it can take a very long time, which means that you're not only do you have a high CAC, it's also highly variable. Like someone could close at cost X, someone else could close at cost 10X, right? So then you need a higher ratio just to absorb that variability.
Absolutely.
You can't be running like absolutely neck and neck at 3:1. You probably have to target a higher ratio so that you have the room for those guys who kind of, you know, cost you a little extra, right?
Maybe it's like on an average, it sort of turns out to be 3:1 is how maybe one could put
it. It's a good exercise for any business to do to find out what works for them, right? 3:1 is a good starting point in the lack of any other data, but it's not something to, you know, kind of absolutely set in stone.
It's not sacrosanct, yeah.
Yes. And the kind of way to use it is also like, okay, if I set a target of say 6:1, right, and then I realize that I'm achieving, say, 9:1. That means I'm making money at a more efficient rate than I targeted, which means I have a little more room to play in terms of growth. Right. Whereas if I'm targeted 6:1 and I'm doing 4:1, I'm still okay. I'm still like not losing money compared, you know, going by the 3:1 ratio. But I need to tighten my belt because I set a target of 6:1. I'm not making that. I need to get more efficient at how I, you know, acquire and retain.
Hopefully,
and make money.
Hopefully that target also had a sort of a strong reason behind it and not just arbitrary, because sometimes, you know, you have these high targets, but then you don't have a strong thesis behind why that number, right?
Correct.
So you tend to kind of punish yourself if you fall below that.
Yeah, that's what this kind of will go well beyond the scope of this. I can probably do like another 2 hour session on this, but this gets into, you know, how much money is in the bank, what's your margin, what's the kind of burn rate, how much does it cost to get in a user? Like, you have to factor in all this to say, like, you know, I can basically, the answer you're trying to say is, I've acquired a user at cost X, I can afford to, you know, let that cost sit on my books for a week, 2 weeks, 5 transactions, whatever.
Sure.
Till it starts to pinch. And that's a very personal question to every business, right? Like, what works for e-commerce X selling shoes is not going to work for e-commerce Y selling shoes.
Absolutely, yeah. Perfect. All right, Aditya, I think that brings us to the end of this session. We've just crossed the 1 hour timeline. Although I think the duration mentioned was 45 minutes.
No, not at all.
Yeah, but I think this was a really rich conversation, full of insights. I think you've shared really awesome stuff. Thank you so much actually for agreeing to talk about this. And I'm sure, you know, we'll bring you back one of these days on another webinar on retention, because this is just the beginning of a series that we are going to have more episodes coming on this topic. It felt almost like a duty to do one on retention because of its outsized impact and its undersized attention.
Absolutely, right? That's what I was just going to say. Like, we talk a lot about tactics, moves, growth, acquisition. But yes, retention kind of takes a backseat. And it does come to bite us back when, you know, we don't look at it. And then, you know, acquisition cost is what then gets impacted when you come full circle.
Perfect, Aditya. Thank you so much, and I wish you a good evening.